From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Well, first of all, for our Jewish friends, on the 13th, sundown, happy Rosh Hashanah to you. This year is going by way too fast. In a moment, paranormal stories of the U.S. Border Patrol. Really looking forward to that. Here is what's happening. With a moment of silence and somber reading of names, victims' relatives began marking the 14th anniversary of September 11 in a very subdued gathering at Ground Zero in New York. Hundreds of victims' relatives gathered carrying photos with the names of their lost loved ones as they remembered the day when the hijacked planes hit the World Trade Center. We will remember them with a few seconds of silence. I know that's not a lot, but don't forget. Howard Bloom, of course, lives in New York, and I'm sure he's got some great comments about this tragic story. Howard, not much we can say on this end.
Actually, George, I think there's a lot that hasn't been said over the course of the last years since 9/11. I watched the buildings burn, then I watched them collapse from my roof out here in Park Slope. And I realized almost instantly that this was not an occasion for mourning the past. If we were to live vigorously as a society we need to be, if we were to fling a finger into Osama's face, we needed to face the future. And we needed to face our obligation to make impossible futures come true. 9/11 is not just a day to mourn the dead. It is a day to dream the future and to commit to making that dream come true. It's a day to take our best talents and make them roar. Why? To defy Osama, to fling a finger in his face, to show that our values, pluralism, tolerance, and freedom of speech can produce astonishments. Look, we've talked about this before. We have created the five great amazements. We've doubled the average lifespan. We have septupled the income of the poorest paid worker. We've added 35 points to the average IQ. We've added 4 inches to the average height, and we've taken peace and multiplied it by a factor of 10. Those are astonishments. We have to make them even bigger and better in the future. We've created the internet, Google, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Amazon. We are astonishing because of our freedom to dream. And most important, we are astonishing because of our will to persist. We are astonishing for our ability to hang in year after year, working until we yank our dreams, struggling and kicking into reality. That's what DARPA did with the internet. That's what Elon Musk is doing with his private industry Mars program. That's what Sergey Brin and Larry Page have done with Google. That's what Steve Jobs did with Apple. Dreaming amazing futures is not just our gift. It is our obligation to make astonishing futures for generations yet to come, to build the wings with which our children's children shall overcome. Never forget the future. It's our job.
And we must constantly move ahead, Howard, as you know. Thank you so much. Strangely, at least 107 people died, more than 230 people injured when a crane collapsed in the Muslim holy city of Mecca in Saudi Arabia. The huge red crane crashed into part of the Grand Mosque, the largest in the world, that was filled with worshipers at the time. Just a very tragic story there. And as you know, with David Pilates, we continue to watch the situation around parks that people are just missing. Listen to this one. Yosemite National Park officials asking for the public's help in finding a missing hiker. The 36-year-old man, Timothy Nolan, had a wilderness permit to go backpacking. He's gone missing. His mother said, you know, hey, he knows what he's doing. He's 5 feet, 4 inches tall. He's white, 130 pounds, short hair. Anyone with information about him, you're supposed to call this phone number. Here it is, 209-379-1992. I'll give it to you again, 209-379-1992. Another person who has merely just disappeared in our park system. U.S. military stung this year for mistakenly shipping live anthrax samples. said that its labs now are being investigated for possibly mishandling other organisms, including one that causes plague. Oh boy, the disclosure came a week after the Army declared a moratorium on the production, handling, testing, and shipment of biological agents and toxins. The man taken into custody in Phoenix Friday, allegedly boasting to friends of his involvement in a rash of freeway shootings over the last 12 days. A police source says that the man is also wanted in connection with other crimes. The Highway Patrol hasn't really arrested him yet, but they are detaining him. It's a very strange story out there in Phoenix, but they believe that it could be several different shooters, not just one. The San Diego-based produce distributor that recalled Mexican cucumbers linked to the multi-state salmonella outbreak is busy trying to find the exact source of the problem. The outbreak has killed two people, one in California, one in Texas, and has sickened 341 other people from 30 states, 70 of them hospitalized. Our food safety expert, Jeff Nelkin, with us. This is a big one, Jeff, and how do you stop this?
Well, the company out of San Diego is Andrew Williamson, and the box that the cucumbers come in have kind of, it's called limited edition, and you'll see, you know, because cucumbers usually come in large boxes. You don't see cucumbers individually wrapped generally.
Right.
So it's something that, you know, we need to pay attention to, and they've identified in their locations, they've closed certain locations, and they're scrubbing them down, but they really don't yet have a handle on, you know, what the problem is.
Unbelievable, Jeff. Cucumbers, for crying out loud.
Well, remember, you know, it's a rough skin. It lays around in all different communities. It, you know, you're talking about potentially contaminated water, mishandling. You know, this tuna is a very unusual type of the salmonella family. You know, it's been around, but it's not seen that often. But if anybody feels that they have any questions about cucumbers, the number 844-483-3864 is the distributor, and you can certainly ask them questions, or if you have any issues, you certainly can call your local health department. Usually the symptoms are anywhere from 12 to 72 hours, and you're looking at severe diarrhea, abdominal cramps, fever. Those are the symptoms. So if you feel, especially people, you know, over the age of 65 or young children or anyone that has a compromised immune system, certainly should be in contact with their doctor, you know, if they have any of these symptoms.
Jeff, can you wash salmonella off a cucumber?
It's possible to wash some of it off, but if it's there, I wouldn't take the chance of trying to, you know, wash it off in the sense that salmonella has to be killed.
But you don't know it's there. That's the problem.
Exactly. So, but the cucumbers in the United States have not been indicated. So it's so far the identification of this Puna variety has only been found in this particular distributor in San Diego. So it's over 30 states, and two people have died already, and there are hundreds of people, you know, sick. So it's something, you know, you want to identify, you know, if this is what they call the limited edition polo-grown cucumbers, they need to, you know, call their respective distributors.
Unbelievable. More reasons to have your own little garden, I guess. Well, thank God you don't live in China and own a dog. A Chinese district government is giving dog owners a stark choice. Get rid of your pets, or will come to your home and kill them on the spot. Even in a country where dog ownership is tightly regulated, the order was issued this week. It is very extreme. The Chinese often appear divided sharply between animal lovers and those who see dogs as a threat to the public. Wow. Oil could plunge as low as $20 a barrel amid a glut of production around the world, according to a report by Goldman Sachs. $20 a barrel. An Italian-Chinese medical team planned to perform the world's first head transplant in China, according to one of the surgeons, amid concerns over medical ethics in the country. Now, we've talked about this before, and we had the Italian surgeon on, Sergio Canavero. He wanted to do this in 2016, but the Chinese doctor is saying, no, This looks more like surgery in 2017. The man who has volunteered for the operation is a Russian-born. He's 30 years old. He suffers from a disease that is progressive and incurable, wasting ailment, but he's going for it. Wow, that takes guts. And American adults, they get a D in science. 22% confuse astronomy and astrology, according to the latest report. I'll tell you, somebody who doesn't confuse things by looking in the sky, that's Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Agency. Peter, what's up there these days?
Boy, lots going on, George. There's some very, very strange things taking place on this planet, and I'm particularly pleased this week to be able to bring some very interesting reports to the Coast listeners tonight. Going back to the 6th, make that the 5th of September, last Saturday night during the Labor Day weekend, two young lads in Ashland, Oregon, just north of California, on I-5, were out camping in their tent. This was the third night that they had slept outdoors, their father writes. And at 11:30 that night, that Saturday night, they came racing into the family home, just terrified, petrified, the father writes. And this report, by the way, is posted to our website. They reported that they were in their tent playing electronic games, and suddenly they became aware of a very, very bright light that was illuminating their tent from above. The older of the two sons, preteens these are, peeked outside the tent, and he saw a huge disc hovering above their yard with all sorts of bizarre lights on it. It suddenly illuminated their tent and the surrounding area like it was daylight at high noon, and suddenly all sorts of different colored lights started skittering all around the bottom of the disc. Very, very dramatic sighting. The two young lads, not surprisingly, raced inside and started telling their father what they had just seen. Long, long story, long report on our website, but the father says he's convinced they were telling him the truth because the younger of the two boys suddenly raced down the hallway in the house to check on his younger infant sister to make sure she was okay in her bed. Very, very interesting report. The next night, Gibbon, Minnesota. I thought they were talking about Hibbing, but it's Gibbon, Minnesota.
Right.
Just about 30 miles east of Redwood Falls. A couple from Florida were camping in Gibbon. They were admiring a beautiful, very intense lightning storm to the southeast of their location. And they suddenly became aware that there was a disc-shaped object with a hump on the top and a hump on the bottom of it. Hovering between them and the lightning storm. They're from Florida. They've seen some dramatic lightning. They said it was the most dramatic lightning storm they've ever seen, and that object, that disc, George, reportedly flew right into the lightning storm.
Wow.
So much for the argument that the discs at Roswell were brought down
exactly
by lightning or radar. Last night, Mayflower, Arkansas, about 30 or 40 miles northwest of Little Rock. Father and son were tending to their fishing boat. The son looked up, saw a very bizarre light streaking towards them, and it suddenly started zigzagging all over the sky, scared the daylights out of them. He raced inside, got his wife, she saw it. It suddenly went away as quickly as it had arrived. And he decided to take a shower. Several minutes later, his wife said, "The thing is back." He raced out, draped in his towel, and there it was again. And he reports that the lights in Mayflower, the whole city, he believes, went dark. There was an electromagnetic interference of some kind. And just to wrap it up, tonight I have taken about 14 reports just in the last 2 hours, George, from all across the United States. Just to close it off, I've received reports from Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Colorado, two from Texas, Maryland, New York, Montana, Washington State, and Cicero, Illinois. Just got a very dramatic sighting report from Renton, Washington, just south of of Seattle, people were in the neighborhood screaming, UFO, UFO. People saw a red light that suddenly turned green and, to the best of my knowledge, then suddenly streaked off. Lots going on, and I appreciate the opportunity
always
to bring this to the Coast audience.
Peter Davenport, National UFO Reporting Center, UFOCenter.com. Up next, Out on Foot, we're going to talk about some paranormal stories of the U.S. Border Patrol. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. We've got a fascinating couple hours here for you. Then later on tonight, open lines. Rocky Elmore is a retired United States Border Patrol agent who joined when he was 34 years old. He served for the next two decades, worked in several locations, including Brownfield Border Patrol Station in San Diego and also Kingsville, Texas, Tucson, Arizona. At the age of 54, he became a first-time father. Congratulations, at which time he decided, hey, I'm going to retire from duty. And my next adventure is an author, and he's written a book called Out on Foot, Nightly Patrols and Ghostly Tales of a U.S. Border Patrol Agent. Well, first of all, Rocky, thank you for serving for what you did. It's not an easy job at all.
Thank you.
I was down in McAllen, Texas several weeks ago, and all of a sudden a whole swarm of Border Patrol agents came up to me, and I'm going, oh, no, what did I do? And they went, love your show. We've been waiting for you. We knew you were coming through here. And just great guys. They gave me one of those Border Patrol patches, the round ones, and just super folks. And as I was leaving, Rocky, they said, come back next time. We've got some great stories to tell you. I bet you could write 100 books on the things you went through.
Yeah, and I wish those stories would come out more and more, because people have a tendency to kind of hold them to themselves sometimes. And I'm hoping that we will hear some more of those. But, yeah, your show is very popular with the Border Patrol agents.
So when you retired, and congratulations on the little baby, by the way, first-time father. That's great.
Thank you. Yeah, it was quite a little surprise. But very pleasant.
Surprise. What got you to write a book called Out on Foot, Ghostly Tales? Well, you got to tell me what's been going on here.
Well, I worked a fairly unique area. I was really fortunate when I went out to Brownfield Station. They were responsible for a set of mountain ranges. So primarily our work was all done out on foot. You really couldn't accomplish much in a vehicle. There was only one small road that went across the top of the mountain. So once you got up there, you got out and you just started hiking around and going through the canyons and the draws and the mountaintops and ridge lines, and most of the time it was most of your shifts were nighttime, so it was just total darkness up there. There's nobody lived up there or anything. So that's where the title Out on Foot came from. And then I just noticed through the years that several agents had some paranormal encounters of different types, mainly ghost stories, and every now and then they would tell them, and I just remembered them through the years and thought, well, one day when I retire, I'm just going to tell these stories, because I don't think anyone in law enforcement has ever spoke out and talked about anything like that. So I thought, well, I'm going to do it.
Was it a situation where when this was going on, when you were still a Border Patrol agent, you guys and gals just didn't say anything to each other about it?
Pretty much, and almost never out in the open. And if you did, you know, it would be someone that you had known for quite a long time, because you really didn't want to get ridiculed, or you didn't want to be the guy that everyone talked about, you know, oh, that guy goes out and sees ghosts, stuff like that.
Yeah, he's guarding our borders, but he sees ghosts.
Yeah,
right?
He sees a ghost, yeah, right. So, no, everybody pretty much held their stories to them, and I did wind up over the years with quite a few stories to tell, pass on, a couple of them my own and most of them other people's. But since the book came out and a lot of my colleagues knew that I was writing it, they have started to come forward with more and more stories.
That's great.
So I'm looking forward to hearing what they have to say.
Well, how scary was it, Rocky, being out there? Think about that. We're going to come back in a moment. We're going to be talking more with Rocky Elmore, the name of his work, which just came out about a month ago, is called Out on Foot. We'll be back. Well, talking about some ghostly stories, which we'll get into with Rocky Elmore here, the Border Patrol guard, an agent. How about ParanormalDate.com? Looking for something to do this weekend? Go have some fun. Just go to the website and sign up. It's free to sign up, and then just see what you like there. ParanormalDate.com. That's ParanormalDate.com. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Rocky Elmore with us. His work called Out on Foot. Rocky, near San Diego, of course, the Otay Mountains, and that seemed to have a lot to do with what was happening with you. Tell us about this mountain and what's the legend behind it?
Yeah, according to the local Native American tribes, the Otay Mountains and I believe the Tecate Mountains, they sit side by side. They were sacred mountains, and it was forbidden for human beings to go up on them. And if anyone went up there, then they would stir up all these evil spirits and these other type beings that lived up there. So they never went up there. But we didn't really have a choice because the illegal traffic started to go across the mountain, and we had to go up there and chase and try to get it under control.
Well, were you able to?
Yeah, we did. We actually were quite successful up there. It took a few years, took about 3 years, but we were very successful. And last I heard, the place is still under control pretty well.
Okay, so when you do your work, were you primarily in a car, on foot? How did you do that?
We were on foot almost all the time. Virtually all the work was done on foot. So we had access to the top of the mountain, and we would drive up there in a four-by. Then once we got up there, we would get busy immediately because there was literally hundreds and hundreds of people every night coming over that, and sometimes maybe as many as 1,000. So when you got up there, you were out of the vehicle, and you were hiking trails and canyons and ridge lines and crossing mountain tops. And one thing that takes a little time to get used to is we work totally in the dark, and that we very seldom ever use a flashlight. So you had to get used to navigating all this stuff in total darkness. And then when you approach the groups, you took them down the same way in total darkness. So you had to get used to walking right up to strange people in deep canyons and make physical contact with them and then hope for the best.
Were they hiding there in tents? What were they doing?
Oh, no, they were up and moving. They were walking. Sometimes they would have to take a couple of breaks before they could get across. It took them probably took them about 3 days on average to get over the mountain.
Of the 1,000, not to digress here, Rocky, but I am curious about this and what you do. Of the 1,000 that would come over, how many would you catch and pull and bring back?
Well, we kind of hit it in layers. We would send, a certain amount of guys up on the top of the mountain, and then we would send other guys north of that on the bottom where they were coming back down. So we'd get a couple of chances at them, and we could easily, well, a lot of times there was only like 3 or 4 of us up there, but we could catch a couple hundred people, sometimes a little bit more than that.
And what do you do with them?
Well, you have to wait for someone to come up in several vans and haul them back down, and then you go out and try to get some more.
And then you take them back to Mexico, or what happens?
Yeah, they would take them back and process them, and if they didn't have a criminal record, they would go back to Mexico within a few hours.
And I bet they would sneak over again.
And they'd sneak over again. Sometimes we would see the same group twice in a night. I think I caught the same group one time, two times in about an hour and a half. Same place.
My God, that's another show all by itself, Rocky, but my God, what an issue that is. I mean, we need probably a zillion more Border Patrol agents out there, don't we?
Probably.
Yeah. Okay, so back to the Otay Mountains. Did anything tragic happen out there?
Yeah, people died all the time trying to cross over there, and I think the time I was out there was probably as many as maybe 300 people that died trying to cross over that. Most of it from exposure, dehydration.
Oh, my God.
Things like that.
Men, women, children, everybody, huh?
Children didn't come too often because it was just too hard for them, and they would have to be carried a large portion of the way. So mainly it was just adults, women and men.
What was the age bracket, roughly?
I would say 15 through, well, the average age was probably 15 to about 40, but I've seen people as old as 70 years old trying to cross that mountain.
Just wanted a better life. That's all they want, isn't it? Sad, isn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Now, at what point did you start seeing, feeling these paranormal episodes?
You know, a lot of them happened fairly early in my career, and a lot of them were concentrated in the valley that sit between the two mountain ranges, which was Marone Valley, and it seemed to be the biggest concentration of activity. But I think my first paranormal event that I perceived as being a paranormal event was probably about 4 months in after we hit the field. And then I had another one probably about 2 years later.
Now, there's an episode that you talk about called The Little Girl in White.
The Little Girl in White was a particularly scary, disturbing ghost, but she was also a heartbreaking one at the same time. And she was one of them that roamed Marone Valley. She'd been seen several different times, and it always had a pretty dramatic effect on the agents who were unfortunate enough to see her. A friend of mine had told me one time about his encounter with her. He had been sitting out near Marone Valley on one of the dirt roads, and he had a junior agent with him. They were sitting. They'd been there for a while. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning, maybe. They started to get a strange feeling, so they started looking around, and they looked across the road, and there was a big tree across the road from them, and right underneath it, they saw this little girl standing there. They thought she was about 3 years old. She was in what they thought was a white nightgown. Said she had just a slight glow to her, and she was just standing over there under that tree, staring at them.
God.
So they looked at each other for a few seconds, and then she faded away. And they said, you know, they just were left with a lot of feelings of sadness and anxiety because they knew that at some point there must have been a little girl that lived out there, and something very bad must have happened to her, but no one knew who she was.
Did she look sad?
They never said. They never said. Each encounter was a little bit different with her, but the agents were always pretty emotionally affected.
Oh, my gosh. And she was just always just like standing there.
No, she actually moved around. That was probably one of the few times that she was seen just standing.
She's 3 years old, but did she try talking to anybody?
I don't know that she ever tried to talk. I didn't ever have that reported to me. We had one incident where we run the night scopes, and they're in a truck, and they're very large, powerful night vision scopes. And this fella had been assigned to run the scope in the south end of their valley, and there was a couple of big, heavy iron gates in the middle of Marone Valley, and it was to keep people out of the south end of the valley because the whole area was under control of the Bureau of Land Management, so people weren't allowed back there other than us. And he was making his way down there, and he had pulled up to one of the gates. And people had always talked about the gates being haunted, and they didn't like getting out and opening them. So he got out, and he was walking up to the gate to open it, and he seen this little girl approaching him on the road. And she was walking up toward him, and he claimed that she was faceless at that time.
Oh, my gosh.
That her face was missing, so he was scared out of his wits, ran back to his truck, and in his haste to try to get out of the area, he wound up wrecking the truck.
Oh, my gosh.
And 3 days later, he resigned and left the Border Patrol.
Yeah, he had enough.
Yeah. Keeping his job wasn't worth risking seeing that little girl again.
When you would hear some of these stories, sometimes witness some of them yourself, I mean, what did you think? I mean, did you think, I mean, my God, what's happening out here?
Well, you would feel the same shivers up and down your spine if it was a good story.
Yeah.
That the agent did when he seen her, especially with this child in white. every time I heard a new story about her, I just got goosebumps all over.
Did you, as Border Patrol agents, work in pairs, or were you by yourself?
We always rode alone, and you patrolled alone. But if you knew you had some traffic to work or something was going to go on, then you would start calling someone to come help you. And usually you could find somebody to come help you. So mostly you were working in pairs, but you did ride alone.
What about Border Patrol agents? Did any of them die, working out there or anything like that?
Several did. My classmate was the first one that had gotten killed on duty while I was in. And then there was two more. One more got killed up on Otay Mountain, and another one got killed at Tecate Mountain.
Was your classmate Santiago?
Yes, his name was Luis Santiago, and we had went through the Border Patrol Academy together, and then our entire academy class had come back out to the Brown Field Station, and we went on to a training unit, and he was killed while we were on the training unit.
How did he die, Rocky?
We had been working some traffic around the Otay Lakes area. There's a lake at north side of Otay Mountain. There's a lake sets there. And there was a canyon that went around the back of the lake, and it ran up to the dam of the lake. And it was a pretty popular crossing spot for people to come up. There was a trail next to that dam, and they would climb up that, and then there was some cliffs on the top when they got to the top. And they were working some traffic there one night, and they were starting, he was with some other trainees and a training officer, and they were starting to go down the trail into the canyon to work some traffic they had seen. And for some reason, Agent Santiago broke away from the group and went back up and ran toward the top of the cliff. They don't know if he's seen somebody there or why he did that exactly, but when he got to the top of the cliff, he fell off of it. And they heard his scream, and they seen his flashlight tumbling down. So they immediately went to the bottom, and he was already dead. He had been killed instantly.
Oh, jeez. Now, when he died, something strange happened with you and your radio. Tell me that story.
Yes. We actually had been scheduled to work together that night, but we'd been hitting that area pretty hard, and it was a real rugged area. And I had gotten pretty dehydrated over the last few days and gotten sick, so I stayed home. And I went to bed a little bit early to try to rest up. And these guys were working, they were working a midnight shift, but it actually started at 11 o'clock. So I was in bed, and I was woken up by a beeping sound inside my bedroom. And it had a rhythm to it, and I had not heard it before. But it had a strange rhythm to it. So I got up and was looking around for the source, and I determined it was in my closet with some of my work equipment, and it turned out to be my service-issue radio. And it was beeping, and it was the source of that. So I checked to see if it was off. I thought maybe I'd left it on somehow, but it wasn't. I turned it on and off a couple more times, and finally it turned off. So I went back to bed, and I looked at the clock, and I noticed that the clock said 12:02. So I went back to sleep, got up the next morning, and I got a phone call informing me that Agent Santiago had gotten killed. And they said it was just shortly after midnight. They thought it was just 1 or 2 minutes after midnight that that had happened. And then I remembered what had happened the night before. So we went ahead and reported for duty the next 2 or 3 nights, like normal, and then we were working a day shift so we could attend his funeral. Then after the funeral, I went back home and was in bed again, getting ready for the next shift. And once again, I was awoken by the beeping sound.
Huh.
So I got up, and I pretty much knew this time where it was coming from, and it was the radio. And I looked over at the clock, and the clock, once again, said 12:02. And I got this really strange feeling that somebody was on the radio and wanted me to answer it. But I couldn't do it. I just didn't have the courage to do it. I tried turning it off a couple more times, and it wouldn't go off, and I finally wound up taking the radio battery off of it. But I continued to carry that radio probably for 5 or 6 more years, and it never did that again. That was the only two times in the entire time I had that radio that that beeping sound ever happened, and it was the night of his death and the night of his memorial service, both times right at the time of his death.
Did you ever see any ghostly apparitions of him?
I did not, but several of the aliens, illegal aliens crossing, did.
Yeah, on this show, when you say aliens, Rocky could be anything.
Yeah, I know. So I'll just have to try to remember to call them something else.
Yeah.
So, no, a few months went by, and these groups of people started reporting that they were being stopped by a phantom Border Patrol agent. They called him El Fantasma. And he was coming up to them and telling them, he would come up and approach the smuggler and tell them that they couldn't pass. And then he would tell the group that he had died and was sad and something was left unfinished and he couldn't move on yet. And then he would tell the smuggler that he had to wait right there and they were not allowed to pass any further. And then within just seconds, or even a minute or two of him disappearing, live Border Patrol agents would show up and find this group just standing there. So they would go up and take them into custody, and then the group would begin to tell them that this phantom agent had stopped them.
It could have been him.
It happened, the first couple of times it happened, we just didn't believe it, and then it continued to happen pretty much the same way every time.
But then they just stopped after a while, didn't they?
It stopped. Yeah, it went for a few months, and then it just stopped. And supposedly what had happened was after a while, he initially was seen up on the mountain, but then after a few months, he was only seen on the cliffs where he had actually died. And one night, a group was coming up those cliffs, and an agent come in to work it, and when he got there, he heard a bunch of screaming on the cliff. And he went over, and there were several people still there, and they were screaming that several more had fallen over the cliff. So he called in some more help, and they did a little rescue effort, and 6 people had went over the cliff, and one of them had been killed. The first one that had went over was killed. And I heard that the second one died later, but I'm not sure about that.
How far was the plunge?
It was 120 feet.
Oh, my gosh. That's a long way.
120 feet. And it was a real dangerous cliff because you couldn't see it until you were right up on it. So it was very easy to just slip right off of it. So they did a little investigation to see what had caused these people to go over the cliff, and they claimed that a Border Patrol agent had chased them over it. So the only person they could think of that was responsible was the first person that had arrived on the scene. So they were starting to investigate it, and the group had claimed that the agent had chased them, firing his gun at them. So they had an agent in mind, and they gave him a paraffin test to see if he had fired a weapon or if his gun had been fired, and it had not been. And then they did a lineup, and the people could not identify him.
Hold on for a second, Rocky. We'll talk more about this when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM.